So, my boy, sitting alone in that restaurant in Montmartre, watching those contemporary favorites of yours, I continued to reflect. How many centuries have passed since I began to observe the existence of the three-brained beings of this ill-fated planet? In the course of these long centuries, many sacred individuals have been sent from above with the special aim of helping them to deliver themselves from the consequences of the properties of the organ Kundebuffer. Yet, nothing has changed here, and the whole process of ordinary being existence goes on just as before. During all this time, I have observed no difference whatever between the three-brained beings of this planet who existed nearly 100 of their centuries ago and the contemporary ones. Are not the beings sitting here in this restaurant the same? And do they not behave just as unbecomingly as the beings of the city of Samleos on the continent of Atlantis, which in its day was considered the source and the place of concentration and of the results attained in the sense of the perfecting of their reason, or as contemporary beings would say, the chief center of culture, and where I also went sometimes to sit in their sacrupiacs, as they call their such restaurants. After Atlantis perished, many, many centuries passed, the three-brained beings increased considerably, and their chief center of culture was established on the continent of Grabantsi, which today is called Africa. Again, many centuries passed, and their principal center of culture became the city of Kurkalai on the continent of Asia, in the ancient community called Tikliamish. In those days, too, I used to sit among them in their kaltani, which were like contemporary restaurants. Was I not a witness of similar scenes there also? There in front of me, that stout gentleman with an enormous growth on his neck, sitting with two young street girls. Dress him in the costume of a kaffir, would he not look exactly like that type I once saw sitting in a kaltani in the city of Kurkalai? Or over there, on the left, at that other table, the young man holding forth in a squeaky voice with such conviction to his bottle companions about the causes of the disorders in some community. Put a chambardach on his head, and would he not be exactly like a real Klian of the mountains, as they were then called? And that tall man alone in the corner, putting on airs and making eyes at a lady sitting with her husband at a nearby table, is he not a genuine Vurunkhits? And these waiters, exactly like dogs with their tails between their legs, serving the people sitting there, are they not Askle slaves? After Tikliamish, several more centuries passed, and I happened to be in the majestic city of Babylon. Was it not the same there, too? Were not the three-brained beings of that city these same Askles, Kafirs, Vurunkhits, Kleans, and so on? Only their clothing and the names of their nationalities have changed. In Babylonian times, they were called Assyrians, Persians, Sikishians, Arabians, and various other names ending in I-A-N. Yes, and now, after so many centuries, I am here again in their contemporary center of culture, this time in the city of Paris. And again, it's the same. Shouting, uproar, laughter, invective, just as it was in the city of Babylon, in Kurkalai, and even in Samleos, their first center of culture. Do not these contemporary beings gather to pass the time in a way unbecoming to three-brained beings, as did the beings of all former periods of existence on that ill-fated planet? Do During all the time I've been observing these unfortunate, not only have whole peoples and many of their centers of culture disappeared without a trace, but even the very land masses they existed on have completely changed or disappeared from the face of the planet, as happened, for example, to the continent of Atlantis. After Samlios, their next center was established on the continent of Grabonsi. Have not the peoples inhabiting it also disappeared in the same way? And if the continent itself has not vanished, at least the place where its center lay is now so completely covered with sand that nothing remains but the desert, known as the Sahara. Again, many centuries passed, their new center was established in Tikliamish, what is left of it but a desert called the Black Sands. If by chance some once famous nation has been spared to the thousandth generation, it is now vegetating in complete nothingness, somewhere not far from the place where it formerly existed. Many centuries have succeeded centuries. I saw their center of culture, the city of Babylon. What has remained of this truly great city? A few stones of the city itself, and a few remnants of formerly great peoples, who, though they still exist, are looked down upon by their contemporaries as utterly insignificant. And what will become of their present center of culture, the city of Paris, and the peoples so powerful today who surround it? The French, Germans, English, Dutch, Italians, Americans, and so forth. Future centuries will show. Meanwhile, one thing only is certain. These unfortunate germs of higher being bodies, which arose and continue to arise in some of the three-brain beings here, are condemned, as I've already told you, to languish in the presence of abnormal forms of all kinds, forms which it has become proper to this ill-starred planet Earth to actualize, owing to the non-lawful consequences arising from the lack of foresight of certain of our most high, most sacred, common cosmic individuals. I was still absorbed in such thoughts, so sorrowful for my essence, when my new friend, the young Persian, returned. After a while, as this restaurant became extremely noisy and stifling, we decided to go on to another place, also in Montmartre. But when we got up to leave, a group of people sitting at the next table who had overheard us talking about the place we intended to go to invited us to join them for a few moments at their table and then go on together. They asked us to wait until a friend of theirs arrived. These new acquaintances, as it turned out, were beings from the continent of America. Although it was growing more and more unpleasant in that restaurant, and the din of drunken voices was increasing, we agreed at first to wait for their friend, but when a row suddenly broke out in a far corner of the room, we left without waiting for those Americans. And the row had started, as it transpired, because one being struck one of his drinking companions on the head with a champagne bottle, simply because the latter refused to drink to the health of the prime minister of some government or other, but insisted on drinking to the health of the Sultan of Tugurt. One of the Americans, who did not want to wait any longer for his friend, went with us to the other restaurant. On closer acquaintance, this American three-brain being proved to be jolly, observant, and talkative. All the way there and at the new place we went to, he talked all the time and made us laugh, chiefly because of his clever and apt comments on the comic aspects of the passers-by and the other customers at the restaurant. Upon questioning him, we learned that this American was the proprietor of a large, fashionable dancing school in Paris. From all that he told us about his business, I understood that the pupils of his school consisted entirely of American beings who came there especially to learn a favorite American dance, the foxtrot. I also learned that this foxtrot was purely American in origin, and that it was all the rage, especially in America. So when we had chosen a new brand of champagne, and this jolly American had stopped his chatter for a moment, I asked him, "Tell me, please, my dear sir, if this is the case, why do you not have your school at home in America, instead of here in the city of Paris, so far from your own country and from the source of this beneficial foxtrot?" "What on earth do you mean?" he exclaimed in a tone of sincere surprise. "But I have a large family. If I had my school in my native country, not only would my family starve to death, but I should not even be able to rent a damp basement in New York to shelter us in bad weather from the freezing north winds there. But here in Paris, thank the Lord, there are plenty of people who want to learn the foxtrot and will pay whatever you wish for it." "I don't understand," I interrupted. "You tell me that all your pupils here are from your own country, and in the same breath you say that over there nobody would attend your school. How do you explain that?" "That's the whole trick," answered this honorable American. "The cause of this is a very little psychological kink, that from among the number of other specific kinks altogether make up the stupidity of my compatriots. The point is that my school is in Paris, or, as informed people say at home in America, in the contemporary Babylon. And this contemporary Babylon is so popular with our Americans that every one of them considers it an obligation to visit this world capital. Every American who has managed to save up even a few dollars simply has to come here. And by the way, do you know, it's not so easy for us to save money in America. It's only here in Europe that they think that in America the streets are paved with dollars. Let me tell you, for the people who live there, those American dollars are really not at all easy to come by. Every cent must be earned by the sweat of one's brow. In America, we do not pay, as they do in certain European countries, for such ephemeral values as fame, renown, talent, and so forth. For example, here in Europe, if some painter or other once happens to paint a good picture and becomes famous, then forever afterwards, no matter what trash he may produce, the public will always pay a high price for it simply because it is said to be the work of that famous painter. At home in America, however, it's a very different story. Everything is done for cash, and every product is valued by its weight and measure. Name, talent, genius, and all that sort of merchandise is cheap with us, and you can only get dollars there with hard work. But fortunately for me, our Americans have many weaknesses, and among them is the passion for seeing Europe. To satisfy that passion, every American, even at times depriving himself of necessities, tries hard to save up, little by little, the dollars he has earned, only to be able to go to Europe, and, of course, to the capital of the world, Paris. That is why there are always so many of my compatriots here that the streets of Paris, as he said, are paved with Americans. And as our Americans have still another highly developed weakness, namely vanity, they are flattered if people find out that they have learned the foxtrot, not merely in Philadelphia or Boston, but in Paris itself, where all the fashionable novelties of the earth originate. And as the foxtrot is a fashionable novelty, the Paris foxtrot is, for them, the last word in civilization. And so, thanks to these two ferments in my compatriots, I, who am only a poor dancing teacher, always have plenty of Americans here who pay me well. True, they pay me in francs and not in dollars, but of course the money changers must also earn something. They also have families. After this explanation of his, I asked him, "Please, tell me, my dear sir, is it possible that your compatriots come to Paris and stay here so long just to learn this foxtrot of yours?" "Why only the foxtrot?" he replied. "While they are here, they also visit the city and its outskirts, and sometimes they even travel quite a distance. In short, during this time, they also study Europe. They visit and study Europe in order, as they say at home, to complete their education and schooling. But between ourselves, this is merely one of the parrot-like phrases of those of us who pretend to be real Englishmen. Actually, my compatriots come to see Paris as well as Europe solely to satisfy their vanity. They travel not to become more learned or well-informed, but simply to be able to boast afterwards to their acquaintances at home that they've been to Europe and have seen this, that, and the other. But do you know how my dear compatriots visit and study Europe? You don't? Then listen to this. Here in Europe, every large town has a branch of an establishment named Book and Son, well suited to this particular need. And of course, there is one of these branches in Paris. Well, then, these dear compatriots of mine gather together like a flock of sheep in groups of several dozen, and a whole party of tourists are seated in an enormous books bus and go wherever they are taken. On that books bus, besides the driver, there's another person referred to as books sleepy type. During the tour of that famous books bus, this sleepy type calls out from time to time in a weak voice the names of the places and the various historical and non-historical sites of Paris and its environs, which he has learned by rote from the itinerary mapped out by Mr. Book himself. These sleepy types have very weak voices and look half consumptive because they're usually very tired and don't get enough sleep, and this is probably because many of them work hard somewhere else at night in order to eke out their tiny earnings from Book and Son, which are not enough for them to live on, since it's no easy task to support a family, especially in Paris. And if my dear compatriots hear little of what these sleepy types say with their feeble voices, what difference does it make? Isn't it all the same to them what that sleepy creature is mumbling or in what voice? They really don't need to know any of the details of what they're seeing. Why should they care what they see and what it all means? All they need is the fact that they were in such and such a place and, in general, saw everything. They are fully satisfied with this, for afterwards, in conversation, they can say with a clear conscience that they were here and there and everywhere, and all the other Americans will think that they are not just the tail of donkey, but have been to Europe and visited everything and seen all the sights that every cultivated person must see. Ah, my good sir, do you think I'm the only one who lives off the stupidities of my compatriots? Who am I, after all? I'm a little man, just a dancing teacher. But did you notice the fat man who was sitting with me in the first restaurant? Well, he's a real shark. And incidentally, this species has been breeding in great numbers in America, especially in recent times. That fat man, an Americanized English Jew, is the principal partner in a well-established American firm. This firm has branches in many American and European cities, and he is the man who performs the functions of director of the Paris branch. This firm not only fills its coffers by exploiting the stupidity of my compatriots, but unfortunately adds its share of sharp practice. And this is how they cook up their shady deals. The Paris branch of the firm, using American methods of advertising, is already widely known in America, and many of my compatriots, impelled by that same vanity and other weaknesses proper to them, regularly order their fashionable wardrobes from the branch here, and this branch sends them genuine French models from the capital of the world. All this is done quite honorably, according to the rules of modern business, and on the basis of triple-entry bookkeeping and Schachermacher accounting. As for the intimate side of the business of this reputable firm, founded by various American sharks, let me tell you how these sharks bleed everyone to fill their own bottomless pockets. Well, then, when the Paris branch receives a mail order from one of its American customers, this is forwarded directly to the branch in Germany, where materials and labor are much cheaper than here. And the German branch slowly and leisurely fills this American order, following all the dictates of Paris fashions, whereupon it calmly sticks a Paris label on its product, and again directly ships it by steamer from Hamburg to its New York branch. And there the client receives her order, happy and proud that tomorrow she will wear not just any old thing, but a real Paris creation made in Paris itself, according to the latest fashion. What is most interesting in all this is that nobody loses out through the commission business of this respectable firm. On the contrary, it's convenient and profitable for everyone. Even the French, who are hosts in the capital of the world, gain something from this commerce of theirs, but it's true only insofar as they make a profit from the postage stamps that the Paris branch sticks on its correspondence. As you see, everyone is satisfied and everyone is pleased and even benefited, and what is more, the whole transaction justifies an axiom of political economy, not universally accepted, by the way, that without an international exchange of goods, nations cannot possibly exist. But what am I? I'm only a poor little dancing teacher. This jolly American was going to say something more, but at that moment we heard a great hubbub in the next room and desperate cries of both men and women. We got up to leave the restaurant, and it was only when we were in the street that we found out that a being of the female sex from the community of Spain had flung vitriol in the face of another female from the community of Belgium, because she had given a present of a cigar case engraved with the inscription, "Always at your service," to a being of the male sex from the community called Georgia, whose existence in Paris had been supported until that day by the first woman. When we got into the street, it was very late. Day was beginning to break, so we took leave of that amusing American and went to our hotels.